Please hold for technical challenges. Good morning and welcome to the 2006 State of the Bay Conference. My name is Dan Berman. I'm the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, and I'm really glad to see you all here today. This is the second day of our conference. We had a wonderful turnout yesterday and a fabulous presentations, and I know it's going to be the same thing today. This estuary program puts on this conference every 3 years, at least that's the plan. We did it in 2003, we're doing it in 2006. We'll hope to see you back here in 2009. And we do it as a free community event to let all of you know and let the community know all the fabulous work that's going on in the estuary, the state of the bay itself, and the many partners that are working to help protect and restore this special place. Without further ado, we're going to get started here. Our first series of presentations are about some of the rare and endangered species that call the estuary their home. We have over 16 federally threatened and endangered species living in and around the Morro Bay Estuary. It's one of the reasons that makes this place so special. And in fact, it's one of the reasons, you can think of it in two ways. On the one hand, it's tragic that these species are threatened and endangered. On the other hand, this is really one of their last remaining strongholds for many of them because the estuary is still in relatively good shape. And so we're going to hear about how some of those species are doing today. Our first presentation is going to be from Regina Orr from California State Parks, and she's going to be talking about the western snowy plover.
Thank you, Dan. Like Dan said, I'm going to be talking about the western snowy plover today. First, I'll be talking about the life history, and then I'll be discussing the status. And then finally, what the San Luis Obispo Coast District of California State Parks is doing to help save the small shorebird. So to begin with the life history, most snowy plovers return to the same breeding site year after year, and often they have the same mate each year. So they get to these breeding sites at the beginning of February, and they start their courtship activities, and then usually by the beginning of March, they're laying their first nest, and then they continue laying their nests through August. They typically lay two nests per season. Sometimes they can lay up to four nests per season. So what do they need to nest? Well, first off, they lay two to four eggs with an average of three eggs over a 4 to 5 day period in flat, open, wide, sandy beaches where they have access to food and they have few predators and they have minimal disturbance. So the eggs need to be kept at a fairly constant temperature of about 99 degrees Fahrenheit to develop. And so when the eggs are disturbed by predators or humans, it keeps the eggs from being incubated. And then the eggs can either get, you know, too hot or too cold when the adults are off of the nest. And so development can either stop or be delayed. So if a nest is lost, the adults, like I said earlier, will re-nest often. So the eggs are incubated by both the adult male and female, and they incubate them for about a 28-day period. Plovers, go on. So for the hatching, you can hear the chicks peeping inside the eggs up to 2 days before the eggs actually hatch. And then the chicks usually hatch within 1 to 33 hours of each other, and then the adults move the eggshell fragments out of the nest up to about 100 meters away from the nest. And then at hatching, the chicks are covered with down, and the legs are almost the same size as the adults. So this chick here is still wet, so all that little wet will fluff up, and it'll be a cute little fluffy chick. And then soon after the nest hatches, the females will leave the nest, and she'll go re-nest with another male. So the male is the one that raises the chicks. The chicks are precocial, which means they're up and running as soon as they're out of the nest. And the adult leads them to suitable feeding areas up to about 4 miles away from the nest. And then the male, it lures predators away from the chicks with distraction display, such as what's in this photo here. And then he also calls to the chicks and to crouch. And that's their only defense mechanism for about the first 10 days of their lives. So up in that upper photo, can you find the chick? It's camouflage, it's hiding, and that's all it can do to, you know, keep a predator from eating it is just lay as still as possible and blend in. And then the male will stay with the chicks for 29 to 47 days, and then at about 28 days, the chicks are considered to be fledged and able to fly at that point. So average lifespan for a snowy plover is 3 years, with the longest or oldest snowy plover recorded being 15 years old. So foraging. Snowy plovers are visual foragers. They use the run, stop, peck method to eat. And then they forage on invertebrates in the wet and the dry sand and amongst the surf-cast kelp. So migration begins as early as July with those early fledged chicks flying usually to their wintering locations. And then by mid-October, most plovers are in their wintering location. Now, some plovers remain in their coastal breeding area year-round, and others, they'll just migrate up or down the coast. And then studies have shown that about 41% of the males stay in their same breeding location year-round, and then about 25% of the females stay in the same location year-round. But most plovers that nest inland, they come over to the coast for the winter. And then these inland plovers will look the same as our coastal plovers, but they don't interbreed. So they're considered to be a separate population segment. So during the winter, we have often up to 500 birds on our beaches here, with about flocks of just a few individuals up to about 300. So now on to the status of the plover. The Pacific Coast distinct population segment of the western snowy plover has been listed as federally threatened since 1993. It's also a California species of special concern. The plover previously nested in over 50 locations throughout California. Now it nests in about half of those locations. Once it was numbering in the thousands, now there's only about 1,700 snowy plovers nesting along the coast of California. So according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service draft recovery plan, for the western snowy plover to be considered recovered, we need to maintain an average of 3,000 breeding adults for 10 years. And these adults are distributed among six recovery units. Recovery Unit 1 is in Washington and Oregon, and that they need about 250 breeding adults. And then from the California border south to Mendocino County, we need 150 birds. And then from San Francisco Bay, they need 500 birds. And then Sonoma County to Monterey County, they need 400 birds. And then our area, San Luis Obispo County to Ventura County, needs 1,200 birds. And then Los Angeles County to San Diego County needs 400 birds. So currently, in the entire range from Washington down to the border of Mexico, there's about 1,900 plovers. So we're at about 63% of reaching that 3,000 goal. And then our recovery unit, which is Recovery Unit 5, from San Luis Obispo County south to Ventura County, we're at about 900 birds. So we're at about 76% of reaching our goal. So 40% of the goal numbers are supposed to be from our recovery unit. And then currently, though, we have about 50% of the entire population of snowy plovers. So, like us, the plovers know that this is a great area to live, you know. So this year we had about 300 breeding adults in the county, and with about 175 of those in the Morro Bay area. The other birds are down in, the Guadalupe Dune area. So in addition to having the average of 300 breeding adults, we need also to maintain an average productivity of at least one fledged chick per male in each recovery unit in the last five years prior to delisting. Also, we need to have plans in place amongst cooperating agencies, landowners, and conservation organizations to assure protection and management of breeding, wintering, and migration areas. So the San Luis Obispo Coast District, the California State Parks, manages most of the plover beaches from the San Luis Obispo County line south down to the Montana de Oro sand spit. But the beaches north of Villa Creek are all pretty small beaches and don't produce a lot of nests. This year we had 11 nests north of Villa Creek. So our three main nesting beaches are Via Creek, Morro Strand, and the Sand Spit. Now, Via Creek is a pretty small beach, but it produces a lot of nests. And then Morro Strand is more your typical plover beach with it's wide, flat, sandy. I'm sure you've all been out there. And it's about 2 miles long where the birds nest. And then there's then the Sand Spit. It's about 5 miles long with birds nesting the entire length of it. So California State Park's mission, in part, is to preserve the state's extraordinary biological diversity by protecting its most valued natural resources, which includes the western snowy plover. We have, in our district, the largest concentration of nesting plovers in the state park system. This chart shows the nest numbers in our district for the past 7 years since we began regularly monitoring the beaches for plovers. In 2004 and 2005, we had lots of predations by coyotes, gulls, and crows. So the high nest numbers are due to a lot of re-nesting, as I mentioned earlier that they'll do. So for this year, we had a total of 226 nests on all of our beaches, with 45% hatching. On the Sand Spit, there was 141 nests, with 51% of those hatching. The main reason for failure out there was coyotes predating the nests. And at Morro Strand, we had 35 nests, with 25% of those hatching. Main reason for failure out there this year was abandonments. Now, we can't be certain of why we had all the abandonments, but we did witness a red-tailed hawk predating two adult plovers. So it could have taken more adults. And by taking one of the adults, it leads to the nest being abandoned because one adult won't maintain a nest or can't maintain a nest by itself. And then at Via Creek, we had 39 nests with 33% hatching. Main reason for failures out there were gulls and an unknown predator. The substrate out at Via Creek is kind of cobbly, so it's really hard to determine tracks. And so we can't determine what the predators are. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, Via Creek is a really small beach, so all the nests are really close together, which is unusual. So once a predator keys into a nest, it's really easy for them just to start plucking the nests away. So. Other reasons for failures this year, we had, I think, just one nest buried by wind, a few nests that were washed out by tides. We had one nest at Morro Strand that was vandalized by humans, and then just some unknown causes. And then the unknown fate there, that means that the nest could have hatched, but we didn't have conclusive evidence that the nest did hatch. So we need to see, like, chicks or something conclusive. So we give it an unknown fate. So this graph shows the number of active nests on any given day throughout the season on our three beaches, Morro Strand, Via Creek, and the Sand Spit. So you can see that the peak nesting period is between May to August. And then you have to remember that after the last nest hatches, they still need the 28 days for the chick to fledge. So, to protect and manage its federally threatened species, State Parks is monitoring, fencing nesting habitat, controlling predators, restoring habitat, providing public education, and enforcing state park policies. So the monitors go through an intensive training process and then go through the application process to be permitted through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the nesting activity is monitored 5 days per week. We're out there looking for nests, and once we find a nest, we record the location, the date it was found, the number of eggs, and then we track the nest to determine whether it hatches or it fails, and then we record the cause and evidence for that hatch or failure. We're also out there looking for any disturbance in the area from, like, either humans or predators. So we're also out there protecting the habitat by putting up symbolic fencing and regulatory signs and interpretive signs, and also out there enforcing our regulations. We also still allow public access at all of our beaches. Then at Morro Strand several years ago, crows were predating most of the nests out there. So we started erecting these 10-by-10 enclosures. And the enclosures keep the crows out, but they allow the plovers to be able to run in and out of to their nests. And the enclosures have proven to be quite successful at keeping the crows out. And then to be able to put up these enclosures, we go through a training process and are permitted through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So urbanization has pushed native predators into the few undeveloped areas that are left. In addition, some predators, such as crows and skunks, are attracted by the presence of human activities, such as like our garbage. Unnatural habitat features, such as landscape vegetation, telephone poles and such, they provide predators with breeding sites. So all of these factors combine often make the natural predator conditions unnatural. So sometimes it is necessary to remove predators to protect the plovers. But we give thoughtful consideration to prior to the removal of any predator. And there needs to be a consistent pattern of predation. And we target only the individuals who are causing the problems. Our predator control is performed by the USDA Wildlife Services, who is permitted to remove the problem species through Fish and Wildlife Services and other agencies. And then exotic plants are removed because they block the views for predator detection, and they also reduce open space for nesting, and they provide cover for predators. Most exotic removal is done during the winter months to avoid disturbance to the nesting plovers. And habitat restoration not only benefits the plovers, but it also benefits other native species as well. For example, this year in Washington, they found an endangered plant that hadn't been seen in about 65 years, and it was found in an area that had been restored for plovers. So we're also doing public outreach this year. One of our monitors talked to the kids at the weekly Morro Bay Surf Camp, and we've also given presentations to the public, school groups, and city and state park employees. In January, I'll be giving a more detailed plover presentation at the Winter Bird Festival. We'll also be doing a walk out there, so I encourage you guys to go out there to the Winter Bird Festival. We're also working with Audubon to increase our outreach efforts even more. And then finally, we're out there enforcing the rules to protect the snowy plover. Some of these are all just state park policies, but they do help the snowy plover, such as no dogs on the beach, no campfires on the beach, and having our habitat areas closed, and then no fireworks or feeding of the wildlife. And if you need more information, you can go on the internet to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Draft Recovery Plan or California State Park System-Wide Guidelines. And I also would like to thank, we had a great plover team this year. They really helped me a lot, and they did put together a lot of these charts and graphs. So thank you.
Thank you, Regina. I think we're all lucky to live in an area with so much state parkland that we can get out and enjoy, and we do need to share the beach. Our next speaker is Mike Harris from the California Department of Fish and Game, and he's going to be talking about the status of sea otters and the efforts to monitor the sea otter populations on the Central Coast. Let me get your show up here.
All right, thanks. Today I'm going to talk about two of the long-term programs that Department of Fish and Game has been involved with to monitor the California sea otter population. Just to first put things in a geographic perspective, the current sea otter population extends from, is there a pointer? This is... from just about Half Moon Bay up south of San Francisco down to Point Conception. It's about 500 kilometers of coastline that the current population is in here. We've got a couple of projects that have monitored this population. We have counts, population counts. These are range-wide counts, and then our mortality studies. The range-wide counts are conducted twice a year. We do spring and fall counts. Our spring count is our primary index. This count is often higher than the fall count. Reason for that is we tend to have better viewing conditions in the spring, other environmental conditions that influence sightability. So that's our main count. Our fall count is still important because it helps support what we're seeing in the spring count, as well as provide an additional information on pup production. Pups are dependent roughly 6 months a year, or 6 months. So counting pups spring and fall, we get a measure of pup production through the year by adding the two counts. We have two different survey methods that we use to cover this entire section of coast: shore-based counts and aerial counts. Our shore-based counts are teams of spotters that go out with binoculars and telescopes, systematically survey the nearshore waters and document findings. For shore-based counts, we need coastline that has good vantage points, high elevation, close to the waterline. Areas where we don't have those type of vantage points, we have to use aerial surveys. Aerial surveys are conducted in areas like Estero Bay, Monterey Bay, Pismo Beach, and then the range peripheries. Once a count is complete, totals are put together, and this graph just shows the raw data. We've got the total count. This is independent animals and pups. You see a lot of up and down. This is raw data. We did not develop any correction factor or population estimates based on our counts. So some of this variation you see year to year may not just be reflective of what's going on in the population, but may be a result of poor viewing conditions in one year or exceptionally good viewing conditions the next year. To help give us a better sense of the trend that we're seeing, Fish and Wildlife Service has developed a technique where we're taking the data and we call it a three-year running average. So what we do here is say the data point here for 2005 is the results from the count in 2004, 2005, 2006, and it's average. So if you look back, whoops, what it does is essentially just smooths it out so we get a better sense of what the overall trend is of the population. All right, so I'm not going to, well, I'll just back up and talk about our highest count here. 2004, we reached our highest count to date. It was just over 2,800 animals. Again, this is a raw count. It's not a population estimate. So we're likely dealing with quite a few more animals along this section of coastline, but the trend is still that we've had some relatively slow growth going on over the last few years. The next project that we use to monitor the population are mortality studies. Department of Fish and Game initiated this back in 1968. We respond to any reported dead sea otter. That project has continued. We make attempts to recover every carcass that's reported. There's a huge network of organizations involved in this. California Academy of Sciences, UCSC, Moss Landing Marine Labs, Monterey Bay Aquarium, all have people that are dedicated to responding to stranding calls and collecting carcasses. When possible, we get the carcass, bring it back to the lab, we try to determine cause of death. If carcasses are freshly dead, a pathologist does the exam, very detailed necropsies, and as I'll show you a little bit later, we got a pretty good sense of what the major sources of mortality are for sea otters. All right, this is just showing the total number of carcasses that were recovered on a yearly basis. As you see, the trend has been for increase in numbers. Some of this is related to population growth or mortality, but one thing you need to take into account here, we've had programs like the Snowy Plover Project or Beachcomber Program for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary that has put regular beach or regular surveys being done in the beaches that typically don't have a whole lot of human access. So, as Regina said, they've got plover monitors out 5 days a week walking some of these beaches, Morro Bay Sandspit being the one local here, where typically I had very little coverage of that beach. And now I'm getting consistent reports of dead otters in that area because of the work the plover monitors are doing. Some of these increases could also be related to the fact that we've had some population growth and some range expansion. Otters moving into sections of the coastline that make it more likely that if they do die and wash up on the beach, they're going to be found and reported. So, you know, just a few things to qualify that data. A lot going on in this, but this is a same stranding data but broken down on a monthly basis compared to the annual strandings. And the big thing I guess I wanted to get across here is the value of collecting baseline data. We're able to look at trends. Here's the 10-year average for stranding by month. And because we've been collecting this data for so long, it lets us identify when things may be not normal. We're dealing with unusual mortality events. Example being here, April 2004, we had 63 carcasses show up, broke all records that we've ever recorded. Most of those were in Estero Bay. Over half of those were between Montana de Oro and Cayucas. A lot of those were fresh, so we were able to get them to our pathologist. Detailed necropsies were performed, and turns out a large portion of those fresh cases were diagnosed as dying of a protozoal encephalitis. As you can see, we've had a couple other months where we've had record-breaking numbers as well. This year, we're on track where we probably won't be breaking any records. I don't think, we haven't had any record-breaking months this year, but again, some of the monthly totals are well above what the 10-year average has been. All right, so this is a look at some of the results from the detailed necropsies. This is a little older data, but it still reflects what we've been seeing over the last few years. A lot on this, but what I guess I want to get across are a couple things. First, the bulk of the mortality we're seeing in California are prime-aged animals. That does not bode well for it. That does not represent a healthy population. Typically, you'd have very old or very young animals that make most of the strandings. We're dealing with a lot of prime-aged animals that are dying. One of the other big concerns is this chunk of the pie right here, infectious diseases. We're seeing a high percentage of the fresh cases is dying of infectious diseases. That is not indicative of a healthy population, a population that has appropriate immune system. Some of these infectious diseases we know are from a terrestrial based source, and it gets back to a concern of non-point source pollution. Protozoal encephalitis, some of these sources of mortality we know have terrestrial based source to carnivores. So we're investigating these types of mortality and see whether or not there's anything we may be able to mitigate. If there is a non-point source pollution, is there some way that we can hopefully avoid putting these agents into the nearshore marine environment where otters are picking them up? The other thing I think I'd just touch on here, since it's been kind of a hot topic lately, is this large chunk over here, shark-related mortality. We've been seeing it here in the last couple months. Late summer, early fall, we've seen an increase in shark-related mortality in sea otters. Since the late 90s, we started to get an increase in the total number of otters that are washing up on the beaches as a result of shark mortality. As you can see here, about 1999, we started getting a larger number of animals washing up with shark-related mortality. 2003 was a record breaker. 51 cases came in that were shark-related. Last couple years, 2004, 5, and 6, we've seen a shift where the proportion of the total mortality in Estero Bay and Pismo Beach are shark-related mortality. 2006, well, I think we're already in the neighborhood of over 30 cases. Most of those have been just in the last month and a half. And Estero Bay and Pismo Beach have been the focal points for those. And that's it. Oh, I do want to acknowledge everybody that's been involved in this work. It's a huge collaborative effort. It's not just Department of Fish and Game. We've got U.S. Geological Survey, Monterey Bay Aquarium, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, UC Davis Wildlife Health Center, UC Santa Cruz, the Marine Mammal Center, and a huge, huge group of volunteers. We got volunteers throughout that geographic range that I showed earlier that help us respond to reports, help us with necropsies, help us work on the data. Thanks.
Our next speaker is P.J. Webb from the Marine Mammal Center, among other hats. She's going to be talking about a very related subject, the new Marine Mammal Recovery Center that's been established out at the power plant here in Morro Bay. And are you?
I
applaud you for that. Let's just leave that up there.
I have no graphs. I have no slides. I have no PowerPoint. This is a technology-free area. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Marine Mammal Center. There is a network of stranding organizations all around the world and all around the coastlines, and the Marine Mammal Center is the organization that is the world-leading institution for veterinary science for marine mammals. Our particular, the Marine Mammal Center, you'll hear about Marine Mammal Centers, there's all different kinds of organizations called that. This is the Marine Mammal Center with the hospital in Sausalito. We handle more animals, more marine mammals are rescued and treated and rehabilitated at the Sausalito Marine Mammal Center than anywhere else in the world. So we are the leaders, and we're very proud to be the leaders. This is an organization, one of the reasons why I don't have PowerPoint, where it's heavily run by volunteers. Over 800 volunteers work at the Marine Mammal Center and along our jurisdiction. When Mike showed you the slide that showed where the southern sea otter population lives, that's pretty much our rescue territory. We actually go a little further north. Approximately 600 miles of coastline in California are covered by Marine Mammal Center volunteers. I have a couple of my colleagues in the audience today, and I wish if you could stand up so people can see you. These are some of the people that work tirelessly. They work tirelessly around the clock for no money. We get to do wonderful things like clean out pens, and there's nothing like marine mammal droppings to really test the mettle of our volunteers. The Marine Mammal Center volunteers, like I said, there's over 800 of them. We have, it varies from 20 to 40 paid staff. So when you think about the amount of marine mammal volunteer hours that go in, it is amazing. The reason why this program works and the reason why we are the world's leading institution for veterinary science for marine mammals is because of all that volunteer work. The mission of the Marine Mammal Center is first to rescue stranded, orphaned, and ill and injured marine mammals. So in this area, we see the southern sea otter. We work with the Department of Fish and Game a lot. We see California sea lions. And since we're on the topic of endangered species and threatened species, the endangered and threatened species that we see primarily are the southern sea otter and fur seals. Once in a while, we'll get a stellar sea lion, which is another very, very endangered animal, but that's very rare. We also deal with harbor seals, and we deal with sea turtles. So one of my purposes in being here today is to let everyone know who to call when you see an animal. We're coming up in the spring on our pup season, and that's when we tend to get a lot of calls. There are cards that are back there. These are little rescue cards, and they give you a number to call. It's 1-415-289-SEAL. S-E-A-L. That's the number you can call if you see an animal on the beach that you're concerned about. Another piece of our education packet is to let you know, don't touch the animals. Don't go near the animals, and take a look at them. Get a good description of them. If you're concerned that there's something wrong with the animal, take down the location, get as good a description, and call us. Our volunteers are dispatched from out of the Sausalito number, and we go out to the beaches. We're trained in assessing the animals, and we report back in to a veterinarian who's trained in marine mammals. So if you see an animal you're concerned, if you think a harbor seal pup, March through May is our harbor seal pup season. If you see an animal, most likely that the pup has a mother who's offshore just waiting for you to leave and take your dog and go away from the pup so she can come back to feed it. But if you're concerned, you call us. And we have volunteers who are so dedicated, they go out. We literally hide in the bushes. And we'll sit there during the daylight hours and watch to see if that pup is truly abandoned. But we go far enough away so that we can observe the pup safely. Another piece of education for the Marine Mammal Center is to let you know that marine mammals come ashore all the time. They come ashore when they're healthy. They're not always sick when they come ashore. The best thing to do is to keep away from them and to keep your pets away. The closer you get to a wild marine mammal, the more you are likely to harass that animal. You change its behavior patterns, and it causes stress on a wild animal. Our volunteers are trained, and we're licensed so that we can actually handle these animals legally. Handling a marine mammal, if you're not licensed and trained, is actually a violation of the law. I wanted to show you a couple of other things in my very low-tech presentation. This is a sign that we put out when we see a harbor seal. People will call us, and this sign says, "Please do not disturb," and it gives you some information. If you see a sign like this, don't go looking for the harbor seal pup. Get out your binoculars if you want to see it, and walk away from the sign. Here's another sign you may see on the beach. "Please do not disturb marine mammal on watch." That tells you we know there's an animal there. We're looking out for it. And if you have any concerns, call us, and we'll let you know as much as we know about the animals. The Marine Mammal Center has rescued over 10,000 animals. It's been organized since the early 70s. The San Luis Obispo branch has been involved for about the last 15 years. We have approximately 70 volunteers in San Luis Obispo County who are kept very busy. When Mike Harris showed you that mortality event in April of 2004, a lot of those animals were picked up and treated when they could be treated by Marine Mammal Center volunteers. This is a huge collaboration. We work not only with helping rescue, rehabilitate, treat, and do research with marine mammals, but we also are concerned with the quality of the ocean health at large. Many of our volunteers work in beachcombers, which is a scientific monitoring and survey program through the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Many of our volunteers do water quality testing on a very frequent, consistent basis. We participate in Snapshot Day, which is, again, more water quality testing. And as Mike Harris told you, non-point source pollution is definitely something we see impact the animals. Some of the things that we see with the marine mammals, we see gunshot wounds. We've had an animal shot with a crossbow arrow. We see entanglements, sometimes of plastic packing straps that come off boats, big shipments. We see entanglement with fishing line. We see illness. We do see sometimes abandoned pups. So we see the gamut. Sometimes people ask me, why do we do this? And the short answer is, because people ask us to. We get calls from the rangers. We get calls from individuals. We get calls from the police department. Sometimes a sea lion wanders up onto Highway 1, and the highway patrol are very helpful with that, but they're not exactly sure what to do with a sea lion. We've had sea lions wander out onto the runway at San Francisco Airport. It creates a problem. So we've been known to relocate very healthy animals when they sometimes wander where they're not supposed to be. I want to encourage everyone, in addition to picking up the card, pick up a couple of them, put them in your car, put them on your refrigerator. That way you know who to call if you have a question. But I also want to encourage you, we have a new site. We're very lucky to have a facility that's been in the planning for many, many years. It's been in construction for many, many years, and it is finally completed and up and running. And that is our Morro Bay Triage Facility. Our Morro Bay Triage Facility is on the property of the power plant. It is not open to the public because it is a veterinary hospital. We do that because there's stress to the animals, there's quarantine issues, etc. But you can arrange to see it on a special tour, and there happens to be a field trip today at 3 o'clock when we will have volunteers here who will take you over and give you a tour of the facility. This facility is going to be, in the event of an oil spill, will be one of the oil spill response network. We'll be dealing with marine mammals on an oil spill level. But on a daily basis, we bring animals here that are picked up and rescued in the San Luis Obispo County area, and we basically do triage. What that means is we assess the animal and we speak with the veterinarians. Frequently, we have to give the animal fluids. We stabilize them for whatever, however they need to be stabilized, and then they go up to the big hospital in Sausalito. I also encourage you, if you're interested, we're undergoing construction in the big hospital in Sausalito, but when that is completed, it's a fascinating place to visit because it's amazing to see how wild marine mammals are treated, rehabilitated for ultimate release. In the process of treating these many, many hundreds of animals that we treat, of course, we get a lot of blood samples. We get a lot of blubber samples. We provide a lot of material for a lot of marine mammal research. And one of the things that's fascinating about that is that the marine mammals, being like us mammals, are telling us a lot of things about what's going on out in the ocean. The kinds of diseases that Mike Harris told you about we're seeing. Every animal that we see, and that's a lot of animals, gets a necropsy, basically an autopsy on that animal to determine how that animal died. We're seeing cancer. We're seeing infectious diseases. We're seeing all kinds of things in these animals that are telling us that maybe the ocean is not as healthy as it was, and that maybe that human beings are creating some of the impacts that are harming these animals. So basically, I want to remind you, if you see a marine mammal or a sea turtle on a beach and you're concerned, please call us. Our volunteers are trained to do this. These are wild animals, and they can be dangerous. They also carry some diseases that your dog can pick up that are also possibly transmissible to you. So if you can, please stay away from them and give us a call. And if you're interested in becoming involved, we have many, many ways for volunteers to become involved. Not only do we rescue marine mammals, but we also do education programs. And there's nothing more fun than going into a school and being able to talk to kids about otters and seals and sea lions and see the joy on their face when they touch an otter pelt and have this amazingly luxurious otter pelt and feel the whiskers of a harbor seal. The kids are our future, and in terms of education, Green Mammal Center is very active in educating the public at large and our future leaders. So I guess that's about all I have to say. Please pick up a rescue card, and if you'd like to see the facility, come to the 3 o'clock field trip. Thank you very much.
Thank you, PJ, and thanks to the Marine folks at the Marine Mammal Center. And give me that back. Let's see if we can wake the computer up here. Good. We've got a couple more things to do before we take a short break. The first is I'm going to make a presentation about the state of the bay, the health of the estuary, presenting some of the current science that the estuary program and our partners have been doing. And then we're going to take a minute and honor some of the folks who helped bring the estuary program here to Morro Bay and are helping to make it a success. Oh, too many big pictures in the slide. A lot of the material that I'm going to be talking about today is either in this or as an update on some of the stuff in here. So I'd really encourage folks, if you haven't looked at this yet, this is Estuary Tidings. This is a report that the Estuary Program put out at the beginning of this year, and it's something we're going to continue to do in the future. And it tracks a whole series of questions about the health of the bay. As you'll see, it's really a complicated question to try and answer. You would think, how healthy is the bay? It seems like a straightforward question. But what exactly do we measure? And the corollary is upstream. How healthy is the watershed? You know, you look at pictures like this, and it doesn't look like it's in too bad a shape. But the question is, what do we measure? You know, you want to know how healthy the bay is. Well, that's a good question. What do we look at? And there's a lot of different things we could look at. We can look at physical and chemical measures. Water quality is a classic way that people talk about the health of a system. The shape of the bay, is it filling in? We can look at biological measures. How are the otters doing? How are the plovers doing? How are the eelgrass beds doing in the bay? We can look at social measures. Are we succeeding in educating people about the importance of the estuary and the resources? And even more importantly than that, are people willing to and are they actively changing their behaviors to help keep the bay healthy? And those are very challenging things, at least for me, being a biological scientist. I don't have hardly the first idea about how we assess those. I think people coming to conferences like this is one way. And, you know, there's counting coup, and this is probably not a good thing to measure, but it's one that we all do. How much money have we brought in? How many volunteers are out there? Kind of simple things we can point to. And in many cases, we want to talk about how healthy the bay is. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and there's pictures like this and pictures like this. This is the storm drain down at the bottom of Marina Street during a nice rainstorm. This was last year, the year before. This is pretty close to our office, so we tend to get a picture of this every year. And I know it shouldn't really look that foamy on the surface. And, you know, it's probably a whole spring and summer's worth of car wash that's ended up in the storm drains, among many other things. I will say, related to this, that the city of Morro Bay has been getting more and more active in their stormwater management program. And just this week, right before the rains, we saw the city maintenance folks out with a big vacuum truck, and they were going up and down the Embarcadero cleaning out all the storm drains and sucking all the material out of them that they possibly could, which was good timing because we got our first rain just a couple nights ago. So back to this question of what do we measure if we want to talk about the health of the bay. We can sit down and come up with a whole list of sort of the ideal things. We'd love to know X, Y, and Z. You know, for instance, how many steelhead trout are there every year? Where are they going? Where are they spawning? But we don't have any practical way to do that. So we come back to what you can measure. We can look at surveys of abundance, probably infrequently. We did a steelhead trout population survey, or some partners did, in a 2000-2001. We can look at habitat quality, because it's a little easier to go count pools and how deep they are than it is to actually see these elusive fish. And I put this picture up here. This is a steelhead, and when you are lucky enough to see them, they're hiding. These are root mass roots, probably from willows or other trees overhanging the banks. So it's really hard to get in there and count the fish. We can look at habitat access. How many barriers are there in the watershed that are blocking access? One of the primary sources of information that we have is from people like you, and in many cases you, who volunteer with our volunteer monitoring program to go out and measure many of these things, water quality, sometimes steelhead. These folks are looking at plankton that are on a microscope right here projected onto the screen. These folks go out and take a plankton sample in the bay about once a month, sometimes every 2 weeks, and look for harmful algal blooms. What else is going on here? I'll mention the city of Morro Bay lets us use a portion of their wastewater treatment plant to do, this looks pretty technical here, but this is somebody just like you who took a little bit of time to get trained to do testing for bacteria levels. And then we're out surveying cross sections, looking up and down the creeks. This is an older map. We've got a new one of dissolved oxygen levels in the bay showing low oxygen back here. And this is from people who get up in the dark in the pre-dawn hours and kayak out on the bay to take samples. And I guess I'll mention, since they're on the screen here, Friday morning, in fact, at 3:30 in the morning, we got our first rainstorm in Morro Bay that was enough to really get the storm drains flowing. And these two folks, Kurt Beebe and Gary Johnson, were out with Annie Gillespie, who's on our volunteer monitoring program staff, at 3 in the morning filling up bottles from the storm drains along the Embarcadero. And so it'll be a little while, but we're going to be able to compare the levels of metals and hydrocarbons, bacteria in those samples, along with the similar sampling that's been done in years past. This is a restoration project up on Upper Los Osos Creek. We started with 30-foot eroding stream banks. We terraced back the banks, planted native plants, sort of a time series of right after. This is as the plants are starting to grow back in. And I put this up here, think about, well, how do we measure the success of this? We can go out to the site and estimate the amount of sediment that we've prevented from washing downstream. That's one way to get at it. But ultimately, the best measure is to look at the bay itself. Is the bay filling in? And that's something we probably want to look at on a 10-year time scale. So back to this report. In this report, we focused in on 8 specific questions, things like, is the bay safe to swim in? Is it safe for human contact in terms of the bacteria levels? Are the creeks safe for human contact? Are the eelgrass beds growing and shrinking? And I can't present up here the kind of information quantity-wise that we've got packed into here, so I encourage folks to look at that. But what I do want to do is highlight a couple of those questions with some updated data. We've got about a year and a half more data for a series of these maps. And this is what you'll find in here is a discussion of the question, the data sources, and then a single map or graphic showing the results so far. And I know you can't read the numbers. You can think of it like the traffic light. Green is better than yellow, is better than red. This is looking at bacteria levels in the bay with one measure, E. coli, which is a sign of fecal contamination from mammals. And what you'll see is that levels up in the northern part of the bay are pretty low. They get worse as we get back in the back bay here. This is 15%, and this is 23%. So that's the percent of the samples we've collected that have been above the standard for human contact, meaning EPA recommends you don't splash your hands in this water, much less go sailing or kayaking in it. And so this is at the Baywood Pier. This is off Pasadena Point. And, you know, there's kind of, well, there's many things you could guess at about this. This is sort of the facts. One observation is that the northern part of the bay is flushed much more thoroughly by the ocean water, so you're much more likely to essentially be sampling the ocean here, although we do try and take these samples on the outgoing tide so that we're actually measuring what's happening in the bay. The other is that there's, you know, 15,000 people here that don't have a sewer system, and their septic tanks are in many cases basically underwater along the shoreline of the bay in sand. And previous work has shown that bacteria levels, that more detailed scientific work trying to figure out the source of these bacteria have shown that humans are a significant source of the fecal bacteria, especially along this area here where we have some kind of freshwater seeps coming out into the bay. So bacteria levels in the bay, kind of a mixed story, but we've definitely got some problems to solve in Los Osos. And this is similar data and actually is better data because the previous map was looking at E. coli. E. coli is not a very good indicator in salt water because it dies pretty quickly when it gets into salt water. And this is another strain of bacteria that's also indicative of fecal contamination, and it's one that's known to be much more long-lasting in salt water, Enterococcus. So this is actually a better test. We have a shorter time series of data because we just started doing this about a year and a half ago. So this is about 15 to 18 samples. So you see 35%, well, 35% of 18. You know, 6 or 7 of those 18 samples have been positive or above the recommended standards. At Baywood Pier, 25% here. And we get a little bit higher numbers here, too. So these are probably actually more representative of fecal contamination. It's a little bit of a mystery why we see less at Cuesta Inlet than we do over in Baywood. It'd be interesting to overlay a groundwater map and see. I don't know if the groundwater is a little bit lower here or what else is going on. We've got kind of a hit here, 17% of the samples off Fairbanks Point, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to show this as a use this as sort of the past and see an improvement there, because we'll talk about this later, but there were about 30 boats moored in this Windy Cove area, some of which we know were dumping trash and probably human waste overboard as well, on and off for decades. And I'm really happy to say that there's now 3 boats here, soon to be none. And so that's been an exciting project this year that we've been involved in, and fishing game, especially Warden Dean Heilman, deserves a lot of credit for that. So hopefully we'll see that number go down. Now we're switching to dissolved oxygen levels in the bay. And again, these are all graphs we had in here, but this is the more current version with another year and a half worth of data. And this one actually looks a little worse than it does in our previous publication. And we're not sure exactly why that is. Basically, what you see is the farther back in the bay you get, the more often we get really low levels of oxygen in the water. And it's not a surprise, because there's less flushing back here. Again, this gets really thorough flushing with the ocean. You get back here, this water tends to sit longer, has a much longer residence time in the bay. Low oxygen levels can be a symbol of nutrient over-enrichment. You get a lot of nutrients. You get these big algal blooms, which we see in the bay. As that algae decomposes, it pulls the oxygen out of the water. And then when you don't have good flushing, that tends to sit there. The danger here is that these low oxygen levels can be really stressful and can even kill fish and other marine life. Now, thankfully, we are not seeing fish kills, which you see in some areas where you actually have dead fish washing up on the beach. So it may be that the organisms here are able to move away and avoid this, or it may be that the levels aren't low enough to be having that result, or it may be that we're just not seeing the dead fish. We don't know, but we do know that this is not a healthy thing for water quality to have levels this low. And a little bit more on the dissolved oxygen. It's kind of a complicated one, because oxygen levels change throughout the day. The previous map was showing those samples were all taken early in the morning, which is when you expect to find the lowest oxygen levels. This is just a single 24-hour cycle. We borrowed some equipment from the Water Quality Control Board and set it out there, so it's reading the oxygen levels every hour. So we've got sunset here and sunrise. So we're starting at noon. Oxygen levels, what we'd like to see is this kind of stable level throughout the day that we see up near the entrance to the bay. And this is basically probably reading ocean water for the most part. And we get back in the back bay. Here's off Cuesta Inlet. What you get is that during the daytime, the oxygen levels go way up because it's hot. And there's a lot of photosynthesis going on with all the algae that's producing oxygen. And then at night, all that algae starts, kind of flips over, it starts using up the oxygen and producing carbon dioxide, and it drops down. Here we're getting down to 3.5 or 4. I think those exceedances were based on 7. Once you start getting below 5, you start getting in a situation that, for a steelhead trout, for instance, is pretty dangerous. And then this is bacteria levels in the creeks, and this was really kind of the most alarming thing that jumped out at us when we compiled and put all this data down on a map like this last spring when we were putting this estuary tidings together. We'd sort of been seeing the numbers on a month-to-month basis, but when you present it like this, there's about 4 years' worth of very regular sampling, monthly or even twice a month. And almost all of the creek sites are essentially unsafe for human contact, according to EPA recommended standards. You know, at least 20% of the time, sometimes 80% of the time, San Lacido Creek is kind of jumping out as the worst here, and we've actually been doing some follow-up work with the help of some really cooperative landowners, trying to sample it at additional points upstream and see if we can get, you know, if there was a single source of the problem here, you'd think, well, if we could sample upstream of it, we'd have good numbers. Below, we'd have bad numbers. We could narrow in on the problem. So far, in just a few months' worth, it seems to be distributed throughout. You know, what's the source of this? Some of it is probably wildlife, natural bacteria sources. Some of it is undoubtedly cattle. And we're working in a number of these creek systems to try and not eliminate, but limit the amount of access cattle have directly to the creek. If you give cattle their preference, they'll stand in the creek all day. It's nice and cool. There's growing green things. And so, and they're standing in the creek. They're also using it as their restroom. But, I mean, the bottom line is we don't know what the specific sources are of each of these problems. We do know we've got some work to do. This is sort of a strange number, and it, you know, you do science and you always end up with more questions. Why the water quality seems to be better here, I don't know. This is right at Twin Bridges. I'm glad to see it that way. It sort of suggests that as, by the time the water's getting into the bay, it's actually less contaminated with bacteria. One theory is that the wetlands restoration work that's been done at the Chorro Flats, you have these floodplains and wetlands, is serving, as the books tell us, as a filter and helping to improve water quality as it moves through there. We'd have to do more detailed sampling along the way to try and validate that theory. So these numbers are not so different than what we had. You know, we added a year and a half of data and saw essentially the same thing. What we're planning to do is to continue to monitor all of these things and more, and essentially update this Health of the Bay report on about a 3-year cycle, have it coincide with these conferences that we're doing, and be able to keep reporting back. And where we want to get to is starting to be able to talk in a meaningful way about trends. Are these things getting worse? Are they getting better? So far, I think we have enough data to say, this is how it looks right now. I don't think we have enough data to say anything very meaningful about what direction things are going. And then this is, you know, another way to measure our progress, and one we have in here is not with water quality, but looking at the landscape and the efforts that have been underway to protect and restore habitats. On this map, this is our watershed here. It's a little bit of an odd look at it from space. Here's the estuary. And Chorro Creek drainage, Los Osos Creek drainage here. Here's the city of San Luis Obispo. The green lands are publicly owned lands, either national forest up here, state parks here. Obviously, the park continues. We've kind of cut it off. The yellow represent habitat protection or restoration projects, essentially over about the last 6 or 7 years. Some of them go back a little farther. That have been done by the estuary program, by partners in the estuary program. As you can see, we've made quite a lot of progress in terms of protecting habitats. Whether that's translating into better water quality, we will see over time. I think I would certainly argue that it has its own benefit, regardless of that. These are some of the properties that folks in Los Osos have worked very hard on to create a green belt around Los Osos. We just celebrated a new 40-acre addition to that green belt earlier this week. This is a conservation easement. So this is privately owned ranch, but the rancher has agreed to permanently basically sell development rights to the ranch. So it's going to stay a ranch forever. And it's really in a critical area if you think about serving as a buffer between the city of Morro Bay and the rural Chorro Valley. This is now an ecological reserve. In the mid-90s, it was proposed to be a sort of sprawling golf course and a huge resort. And then the orange is areas where we've got projects in the pipeline, whether stream restoration. This is a land acquisition project that we're partnering with the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County on. So this is another way to measure our progress, and I think a really valuable one. And we'll look at that. We've actually got a copy of this on the wall back there if folks want to look at it in more detail. This was our summary from the estuary tidings, the 8 things we focused on in there. Shorebird surveys seem to be, we have a lot of birds here, and the abundance and diversity seems to be pretty stable over about the last 10 years. We're doing a lot of work with sedimentation and erosion upstream that we can point to, but we're still very concerned about the fact that the bay is filling in and we have a lot of sediment coming down the creeks. We actually saw yesterday a presentation on some fabulous new data looking at the actual bathymetry of the bay, which is the ultimate way to assess whether all those efforts are working. Is the bay continuing to fill in at this rapid rate, or are we succeeding in slowing that down? We seem to have high nutrient levels and low dissolved oxygen in the creeks in the bay. And then bacterial contamination really stands out as a problem. We're making a lot of progress on protecting lands and restoring habitats. And the eelgrass beds, which I didn't talk about, really had a dramatic crash in the mid-90s and have recovered, but they don't seem to be back at the levels that they were before that crash. I close with this, which is don't just stand there. We all have a role to play in helping protect the bay and trying to move those trends to the up direction. So that's a really quick version of the state of the bay, at least as far as we've been able to monitor and track it. We've got time for a few questions about that and questions for our former panelists, just about 5 minutes, and then we're going to move into another thing. So if folks do have questions, it's probably just going to be a handful. You need to come up to the mic up there, and I'll be happy to play moderator here.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. In your presentation, you noted a few items that I had to clarify. First of all, you mentioned that the creeks had a large concentrations of bacterial at the top, and I believe that these creeks still are not opened as far as the ability for fish to go up, if I'm incorrect about that, that there are still stoppages for the fish, and so therefore they're still not draining correctly. Some of these creeks still have dairy cattle in them doing their thing there, and that's a problem. Is that correct? Also, So the steelhead question is not just a question of the ability of the steelhead to get into the bay, but also and use the bay as a nursery, or the estuary in the bay, but also the fact that they can't get to where they got to go to do what they got to do to have children. Also, you mentioned the bacterial content in the back bay was high and possibly a human source, but I don't believe that there is any real conclusive evidence that that is the case. And I'm not saying that it isn't. I'm saying that if we're going to point our fingers, that we need the proper data. And I'm wondering if the data is there. Historically, the back bay does not flush very well. And also the salinity changes tremendously, not over in the cycles of 20 to 100 year cycles, but also within the cycles of the year. And in fact, I believe the bay raised its salinity so high that it was damaging to the organisms that needed fresh water 1 year. And so I wonder if one can say that Los Osos sewage problems are the cause of the bacterial load, when the bacterial load has always historically been very high, in fact, has gotten so high as to kill off large quantities of the fish. And so I wonder if you might backtrack on that issue. Also, the plankton issue. You suggested that there was you were doing studies of the plankton. And to my knowledge, your studies of plankton, which, by the way, I think are very good, and you should continue. I'm not suggesting that NEP or your organization is doing a bad job at all. I am suggesting that the plankton studies are completely underfunded and incomplete, because as you know, there's two types of plankton. Plankton that comes from the estuaries, which are different than the planktons that come from the ocean. And your plankton study only is interested in the plankton that comes from the ocean. If I recall, after discussing it with your people, unless that has changed, and you have no facilities to determine the different kinds of plankton, which is an essential issue on plankton. You can study the quantities of plankton, and you can do those kind of charts. But if you don't know where it's coming from and what its function is, then it's a very incomplete.
Can I get a chance to answer your
question? Yeah, I'm sorry. I had so many things to go here. And I'll sit down. I'll get out of here, okay?
Thank you.
Okay.
I think that's about enough and for
okay.
one.
Okay, okay.
Thanks. I don't think I took good enough notes to answer all of those. In terms of the wastewater and the bacteria problem in Los Osos, I think there is pretty good science showing that a significant proportion of the bacteria that's seeping into the bay there is of human origin. Where it's coming from exactly, we haven't put dye tabs in anyone's toilet and tried to track them into the bay that I know of, but I think it's very clear that there's a bacteria problem there and that humans are a significant part of it. And I see no reason not to think that a real sewage treatment system wouldn't solve a lot of that problem. Steelhead in the watershed, we're certainly concerned about access for fish in the watershed. That's one of the things we talked about in here that I didn't touch on here, but there are barriers to steelhead migration that are a significant problem for the steelhead, and we're working to try and pull some of those. We've succeeded with some, and we're moving forward with some others. And then plankton-wise, we have our plankton surveys are done by volunteers who've taking their time to learn as much as they can. They identify as many species as they can. We're primarily looking for harmful algal blooms. And when we see those, we can report them to the Department of Health Services and have them respond to them. And they actually follow up and do a much more detailed analysis of what's there and what's not.
Yeah, Bill Martini. I just wanted to make a comment as far as the steelhead in the creeks. Neighbors, friends of ours up San Luisito Creek have photos of mature steelhead last winter going up San Luisito. So as far as barriers, I'm sure there are barriers, but the steelhead are coming up the creek. So just one point. Second point, as far as source pollution for humans, wanted to mention another issue is liveaboards in Morro Bay. On moorings that are not being monitored, I'm not saying every liveaboard is a problem, but there's quite a few liveaboards that stuff go over at night, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed as far as human pollution. Thanks.
Thank you. I think a lot of the barriers in the watershed seem to be such that adults are able to swim over them and get upstream to spawn. They're more of a problem for the juvenile steelhead that ideally would be able to move up and down the system in the summertime, especially to find places of refuge and cool water. And so, for instance, there are barriers on San Luisito Creek that we know the adults can get over them during high flows. We also know that the juveniles, when they come down, can't get back up. They're not big enough to jump back over them. And so those are still problems, even though I'm glad we're seeing some adults up there. I think that at this point the number of returning steelhead spawning is, in the tens, and we certainly want to see that going up. Liveaboards in the bay, it's definitely a concern. It's a very challenging thing to try and address. It's kind of the Harbor Department has been in steady contact with us trying to think about ways we can get at that. But it's definitely an ongoing issue, and we're doing a lot in terms of education and providing pump outs, and the city is, but it's a difficult thing to enforce. We've got time for maybe one more question here.
My question is for the otter and seal folk. On the otter presentation, there was up to 20% of the otter fatalities was caused by shark bite. And I was wondering whether there's an ability to determine the difference between a shark bite and a propeller slash. And the second part of the question goes to the seal folk, is that I didn't hear any fatalities caused by sharks. And it seems strange to me that you have such a high percentage of otter fatalities by sharks, but none of the seals or seal pups fatalities by sharks.
Thanks. First question, how we identify otters as being bit by sharks compared to propellers. There's a few different indications that separate those two. Propeller cuts tend to have a very characteristic cut on the body, one side being undercut, the other side being shaved. The patterns of white shark bites on otters is a more of a stabbing pattern. Instead of slicing, it's a stabbing pattern. Plus, we often find tooth fragments in the bitten otters, or we'll also find patterns of teeth scratching bone. White sharks have a serrated tooth, so when a tooth hits a bone, it leaves a nice parallel scratch pattern. So these are kind of the things that we diagnostically go through to determine whether, you know, we've got a number of different categories we'll put a dead otter in if it has any type of wound, that it's whether it's lacerated, possible shark, or a definite shark. And it's just going through eliminating these, you know, other sources that allow us to put it in a category that's certainly a shark-bitten carcass. You want me to take... We don't think... We have no evidence that white sharks actually consume otters. The bite patterns are all such that it's an initial mouthing event is what we call it. There's no soft tissue that's ever removed. Compared to a pinniped, most pinnipeds are going to be consumed, so you're not going to see that deposition up on the beach. We have no indication that otters have ever been eaten by a white shark, and so that's why we see so many on the beach.
I'll address the steel.
Okay, I neglected to mention predation. We do have predation of harbor seals, sea lions. We do have animals that show up with bites. Frequently, though, they're lost at sea. You know, if they are attacked at sea, we won't see them. But we do. In fact, we just had an elephant seal juvenile show up, I guess, about a week and a half ago that had been presumably shark bit. Actually, that animal is now currently being rehabilitated and will be released shortly. He's actually going to do okay. So we do see them bitten by sharks.
I know folks have lots of questions about the health of the bay, and we don't have time for more of them now, but I'm sure you'll find me later. At this time, I'd like to honor and thank some people who I'm calling estuary heroes. These are folks either in the past or in the present that are really making a big difference or have made a huge difference in our efforts to protect and restore the bay. It's been more than 10 years now since Morro Bay became part of the National Estuary Program. We were officially recognized as an estuary of national significance, I think, in 1995. And that was, you know, from one perspective, a beginning. It was also the culmination of many years of very hard work, almost all of it totally volunteer, by really two organizations in particular, the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay and the Friends of the Estuary at Morro Bay, were kind of partner groups that were started, I think, in the mid-80s. And even those were building on the efforts of people before then. This was a cutting from the Sun Bulletin in 74, and I'd be interested afterwards to talk to anyone who can tell me anything about Tino Patry, but this was... It starts a bid to save California's last undeveloped estuary south of San Francisco, and that met January 31st in a tightly packed room at the county courthouse. So I won't tell anyone how old I was in February 1974. But this man and many other people were working very hard to protect Morro Bay at that time. And this was one future for the bay that didn't come to pass, which I'm very grateful for. And this was really somebody's vision to turn it into essentially sort of a Marina Del Rey of the Central Coast. I think these were going to be thousands of moorings lining this, a bridge across to the hotels and condos on the end of the sand spit. And, you know, I don't think it's a stretch to say that this very well could have happened, and we're pretty lucky it didn't here. And I think it didn't because people cared and didn't want to see that happen to Morro Bay. So we became an estuary of national significance in 1995, or were recognized as such. I would argue we always had been. but we were recognized as such. And then there was about 5 years, 6 years by this date, of really hard work bringing together all of these groups and organizations here, agencies, nonprofits, counties, many of whom are still very active in the program, if not all of them, to come up with a comprehensive plan for how are we going to pull this off. What are the problems facing the Bay? What can we do about them? And we've done a lot. And I guess before I, well, I'll just so that we know what we're honoring these people for, the ESTRO program is really a big tent. We're kind of an umbrella group. We help support a lot of other organizations in their efforts and try and provide sort of a central clearinghouse for all of these different groups that are working in and around the Bay. And between all of us, we've seen over 3,000 acres of habitat protected in the Bay and watershed. We've done a huge number of restoration projects, many of them on private farm and ranch lands with ranchers and farmers that want to help improve water quality. We've given over 50, I think that's over 60 now, grants to other local organizations. We have a volunteer monitoring program with over 100 folks at any given time collecting critical data about the health of the Bay. And could folks who are part of the volunteer monitoring program who volunteered with us now or in the past stand up for a second? Please stand. Thank you guys so much. So this is really the approach that we've taken, protecting habitat and water quality, restoring habitat and water quality, education and outreach, and then monitoring the health of the Bay. And I guess before I go any further, I would like to honor some of these folks who helped make this plan happen and are really in some ways responsible for everything that you're seeing today. And there's no proper order to do this in. But if, as I call your name, for folks that are here, not everyone was able to be here, but if you could come up here and we can give you a hand. The first one I happen to pick up here is for Lawrence or Bud Laurent, who is a supervisor of this district. And Bud was really right in the middle of helping get the ESTRO program status and his work as a supervisor and before that and for the Fish and Game Department here in protecting and restoring the Bay. Thank you, Bud. Welcome to Solar
Foundation. I was going to say it's good to see a lot of old faces, but that's chronologically a very poor choice of adjectives. It's really great to see a lot of old friends and Don Parham in particular. I haven't had a chance to talk to Don yet, but I know he's on your list, and he's certainly one of the more important people to recognize. Just real quickly, I know you don't have a lot of time. You don't want to hear a lot of stuff, but this is a wonderful occasion. I'm really pleased to have been invited to come back and to see a lot of people who I know have done a lot of work over the years to get us where we are today, and new folks stepping in to walk beside those who have worked in the past. I consider myself a real lucky man in that for 10 years I was the marine manager here in Morro Bay with responsibility for marine resources and fisheries and things like that, but I had a lot of latitude, and with that latitude I turned my attention to the estuary. And as Dan indicated, there had been a lot of work done before in the 70s, 60s and 70s that indicated the special nature of Morro Bay and how it was we were losing it, but yet nothing was happening. And I was fortunate that I had the access to fish and game resources, in particular a plane with a belly port in it, and I began doing photographic surveys on an annual basis. And with those slides began holding public meetings to show people and comparing against old maps that I was able to find at UCSB how the bay was filling in quickly. And that got the attention of the Coastal Conservancy and Carol Arnold, and pretty much from that the rest is history. And then everything formed after that with Jeff Haltner's work, et cetera, to give more statistics to the way that we were losing the bay. So it was a great honor to be associated with it in those days, and then as a county supervisor to help where I could to push those who are continuing to work in the area along. and support them where I could. And it really does my heart good to see that it's still, you know, continue today is strong and maybe stronger than ever. And one thing that I also took from your comments, Dan, is that it took us a long time to get to where we are in terms of degradation. It's going to take a long time to really accomplish anything resembling restoration. And it's only with the sort of dedication and commitment as shown and lived by folks in this room that we're going to get there. So my thanks to you and everyone else involved who couldn't be here today, and Dan, for you taking up the gauntlet here too, for all the work you've done. It's been a privilege to be associated with you.
Bud stole my thunder here, but the next person I'd like to recognize and celebrate is a Don Parham. If you could come up, Don. And Don was one of, or maybe the founding member of the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay, which continues to be the nonprofit that helps administer the estuary program. And I'll just read one of these. They say, the Morro Bay National Estuary Program hereby recognizes and celebrates Don Parham as a friend of the Morro Bay Estuary in honor of your outstanding public service in protecting and restoring the Morro Bay Estuary and watershed. One of Don's colleagues, kind of in the same, at the same time, and his counterpart in many ways with the Friends of the Estuary organization, is Bill Newman, who's still very active in local Bay issues. Bill couldn't be here today at a family gathering out of town, but I'd like to honor Bill Newman. And somebody I couldn't convince to come to our conference is Mr. Leon Panetta, who has a pretty busy schedule these days. He's moved from saving Morro Bay to trying to save the world's oceans in general. But Leon Panetta, as our congressional representative here, and really took a very personal interest in Morro Bay in particular, and helped us a lot with the, well, I should say us, in the larger sense, played a really key role in the Halls of Washington, which we desperately needed to become part of this national estuary program. So we definitely owe a debt of gratitude to Leon. At this time, I'd like to thank Supervisor Shirley Bianchi and ask her to come up. Shirley has a both advocated for the Bay and for coastal protection in general on the Board of Supervisors for the last 8 years, and has also in that role been a member of the Executive Committee of the Estuary Program, and so at a more day-to-day level helped steer the program. Thank you, Shirley.
Well, some of you have heard me say this before, but one of the best things about the job that I have is standing on the sidelines and cheering people on to work really hard, and then I get the award. So I truly want to thank everyone who's worked on this, and Dan for his dedication. So thank you all very much.
Some of these folks, I read the name and then look out to see if they're here or not. I'm not sure. But Bud mentioned Carol Arnold at the California Coastal Conservancy. And Carol, I think the phrase Bud used talking to me before this was the godmother of Morro Bay in some ways. Without the support and funding from the Coastal Conservancy, much of the early work, both protection and restoration and the science work that went into becoming a national estuary, would never have happened. And that commitment from the Coastal Conservancy and recognition of the special nature of the stretch of the coast, and investment in helping protect it has continued to this day. Timothy Duff is the current program manager for this area for the Coastal Conservancy, and I wanted to recognize him and Carol and the Coastal Conservancy in general for their role in helping protect Morro Bay. Tim told me he was going to be here, but then the surf got really good. And the last person I'd like to recognize is maybe at the opposite end of the age spectrum from some of the folks we've been talking to, and that's actually one of my staff members who was out at 3:30 in the morning a couple nights ago sampling stormwater, who's been volunteering for us for years. And you know, we have this volunteer program. We get a lot of calls from Cal Poly students, and most of the time it's barely worth the effort because you train them and they come for a couple times and then they're off doing something else or graduating or annoying things like that. Well, Annie came in and has really been at the opposite end of that spectrum. She's shown an incredible commitment and devotion to the program as a volunteer, as a staff person, and then really recently stepping up in a huge way and helping manage and run the volunteer monitoring program at a tender age. So if Annie could come up here to thank her. There's sort of no good way to know where to cut it off when you start giving out awards for being friends of the estuary. I think many of the people in this room deserve that title and should wear it proudly, but I'm not going to ask you guys to wear your hands out any further at this point. I think we're going to take about a 15-minute break before we come back, if I've got my program right. No? Yes? We're starting back up at 11, so we've got 20 minutes, if I'm reading the clock right. And I'd really encourage folks to take a minute to look at all the posters we've got displayed out there. And then we have a new publication that we just completed. I think the box has showed up Thursday, called Making a Difference, and it's really some highlights of the estuary program's work over the last 10 years. And I encourage folks to grab a copy of that. And thank you so much for being here.